culture today. You know, 1 Chronicles 12:32 talks about the men of Issachar who had understanding of their times to know what Israel ought to do. And our objective in looking at our culture is trying to understand people. If we are to go into all the world and make disciples, you have to understand culture, and especially some of you men that have served as missionaries overseas or in different cultures. You know how important it is that we understand our culture. But you know, because you were born in America and lived in America, you may think, I know this culture. Well, let me tell you, if you were on a college campus 10 years ago and you knew college students and you're there today and you think you know those college students, you could not be more wrong. You talk about cultural shift. Now, it's almost like the difference between I've had the privilege of being on one campus for 28 years. And the difference between the University of Oklahoma now, and when I came, is the difference between daylight and dark. It is unbelievable, the difference. You know, when I first came, most of the students, you could give them a little bit of basics, give them some vision, take them to some conferences and expose them, and I mean, they were off to the races. But it's a different ball game today. In 1975, I took a year off the college campus. I wanted to see some of the world and just see what missionaries were facing. So I spent about a month in the Orient. I spent 5 weeks in Europe just going around visiting missionaries and different ones. And Dean Moore helped with that enterprise and said one of the guys he wanted me to visit with was Geert Dierenbaugh in Holland. And I remember one day getting on a train and going across Germany, and I get over there in Holland, and I go to a half-day navigator conference. 1,500 people at a half-day navigator conference. They met out at the fairgrounds. And that was 1975. In 1985, 10 years later, I happened to be at Glen Eyrie, and I walked downstairs in the King James Room one day, and there's Geert Dierenbaugh, and I began to talk to Geert. And he said, you remember when you were in Holland? I said, yeah, I remember it well. He said, remember that conference we had? And I said, yeah. He said, you know, today we have a navigator on every campus in Holland without exception. And at that time when I was there, he had had some fellows he'd worked with on one campus, and they had just gone to some of the other campuses, and the work was very new. And he said, today we have a navigator on every campus in Holland. He said, today if we have a half-day navigator conference, we're fortunate if we have 150 people. And I said, Geert, what happened? And he said, well, at one time, the gospel was really preached in the churches. He said, when I first went to I started to work on the campuses, you could walk out on the campus and invite a student to be in a Gospel of John Bible study. And he said, within 6 weeks, he had become a Christian. He said, you walk out on the campus today and ask the student to be in Bible study, and he'll just laugh at you. And you know, I remember coming back that day from Glen Eyrie, scared stiff. I thought, exactly what I see happening in Holland is beginning to happen in America. We're beginning to see a real shift. Now, one of the things, men, is I know for years, when I graduated from high school, I went to Texas A&M, which was an all-men school. I was there 5 years. I was involved on the campus, and then I went straight from there to the seminary, and I was real engrossed in that. For 1 year, went full-time, and then I started doing student work in Dallas. For the next 5 years, I was going to school, and about all I ever did was go to class and go work at 3 BSUs and go to church on Sunday. And then I went to Oklahoma University and got really involved. And a lot of things kind of bypassed me that were going on in the culture. I don't know if you've ever felt that way. You're involved in ministry and your family and all this. And so I hadn't done a great deal of reading. I kept bumping into things that I didn't understand real clearly at times. And a few years ago, I said, I'm going to do some reading and try to learn everything I can to see what's going on, because there's some men that are sure more perceptive than I am about this. And you know, some things started happening. You have your sheet here on understanding our culture. Let me just go over some things with you. You know, the seniors in our culture, those that were born before 1926, and here are just some things about them. I'm in the group. I was born in December of 1936, so I'm one of the ones that, if you read about, we're called the Builders. Let me give you some characteristics of that group. They were not born with a silver spoon in their mouth. They were intent on building America into a comfortable lifestyle, to a superpower economically and militarily. I heard this growing up myself. My dad used to say this, I don't want my kids to have it as hard as I had it. Some of you growing up, maybe you heard your parents say that. You know, before about 1926 in America, everyone had it pretty hard. You just grew up in America. You worked hard. That was expected. People worked hard. A lot of people didn't have very much. You had a basic living. And now there were some that had, you know, were wealthy, but most people weren't. It was a rural community. We were a rural agriculture country, mainly, and some manufacturing, and people just worked hard, and that was just expected. That's right. And fellas, one of the sad things I think in our day is one of the things I've hated to see is agricultural community go down. Because one of the things, see, kids learned how to work. You grew up on a farm, you learned how to work. I know that I had worked as much, and though I didn't, we lived on a small place outside town, but I always worked on a farm all the time growing up. I'd spent it probably, I had four or five, I probably had worked more than most kids work by the time they've been out of college 4 or 5 years. But see, my son growing up in Norman, Oklahoma, and with the government regulation thing, who can hire an 8-year-old? And so what can he do? He can feed his dog. He can take out the trash. He can make up the bed. And that's the way your kids, a lot of them, were raised too. I mean, nobody can hire them. He can, when he gets a little older, he can mow the lawn. And my son will be graduating with a master's degree this spring. He had had one job in his life other than mowing grass by the time he graduated until he had started college. And so kids don't grow up learning how to work like they once did. And so that's had a tremendous effect on our culture. And now we're going to see more and more. As American farm, to a large degree, is dying. Kids are going to be raised in the cities and things like that. And that's going to affect them because they're not going to learn to work in a lot of things that kids used to learn. Well, but something began to happen. The older people, those that are called the builders, they worked to build a great America. And they succeeded because they worked hard. That was just the way it was. And these people had some values as far as the home and that thing were important to them. Now, one of the sad things, a lot of them didn't have much training. I don't think my mom and dad ever read a book their whole life about marriage and that type of thing. But then in 1946, something happened. Let me just tell you a little bit about this quickly. But at the close of the World War, there was a tremendous optimism in America. I mean, we had gone to war. We had helped win that war. And I can remember even as a child the sacrifice that America made to win that war. When I was a little boy, I wanted a metal gun one Christmas. There wasn't a metal gun. You couldn't find one in America. And so what I got for that Christmas was a little gun. It was made out of sawdust and glue. You drop it on a piece of concrete, and I mean, it'd shatter everywhere, but... And I can remember we couldn't buy tires, and we had rationing, and you didn't just go down and buy all the sugar you wanted or anything. The whole American economy sacrificed for that war effort. Well, when we won the war and the American servicemen came in, we had these mammoth factories, and we had turned all of our factories. We'd built these factories for the war efforts, and now we had all these mammoth factories. What were we going to do with them? Well, we decided we would make consumer goods, and I mean we made consumer goods. And over half of everything produced in the world was produced here in America. And we were going to become a consumer nation, which we did. And it was phenomenal when the American servicemen came home. And two, you know, they'd miss their wives and all that, and people expected we'd have a few more children born, but nobody saw what was fixing to happen in America. Fact is, at the fifth anniversary of General Electric, they decided they'd give a 5 shares to stock to every baby born to one of their employees. They had 225,000 employees at the time working for them, and they thought they'd give 5 shares of stock to every employee that was born on that day, on the day of their anniversary. And so they talked to the demographers, those people that figure statistics and all that, and they thought maybe at most it'd be 19 babies born on that day. Do you know how many babies were born that day? 189. And that was just an example of what was happening in America. We had no idea what was fixing to happen in America. And I mean, we had kids, everybody was having babies. Now, people weren't necessarily having large families, but there's an optimism. Everyone wanted to have children. And it's amazing how those children began to change America. That was when we began to see the people moving out of the cities. The suburbs almost doubled in one 10-year period in America because people said, I don't want to raise my kids in the city. So the suburbs started. Well, it's when we went to the suburbs that we went to a two-car family because you got to haul the kids around to music lessons and all those types of things. And so some tremendous, I mean, all of a sudden, we're having an influx of people in America, tremendous growth. When those kids started hitting schools, we weren't anything like ready for them. In Los Angeles alone, they hired 1,000 new school teachers, more than it had the year before, for the next 10 years, and could not keep up. We were meeting in school fronts. We had kids, I mean, everywhere. And that's when something else started happening in America. We started dealing with kids in groups because there's so many of them. That's when Boy Scouts and Little League and all of this stuff started growing. And we started growing, I mean, dealing with children in little groups. Now, something else began to happen with that. All of a sudden, the parents no longer were the primary influence in children's lives, but it began to become their peers. And so, because we were dealing with them in these little groups, and what this little group thought was important became very important to that kid. Just for example, to show you how America, we decided we're going to make consumers out of this new generation, all these babies we've got. And so we're going to make consumers out of them. December of 1952, I believe it was the year that Disney World came on with Davy Crockett. And so that Christmas, Davy Crockett came on. In the next 9 months, at that time, the coon skin was about $26 a pound. But when Davy Crockett came on with his little coonskin cap, coonskin went to $8 a pound almost overnight. You know, Spielberg, who's done so many of the movies, just did the latest one, Schindler's List, and some others, Star Wars, all these things. He said when he was in the third grade, one day he went to school without a coonskin cap on. He said, I was the only kid in the third grade that did not have a coonskin cap. So he said, I had to be Santa Ana, and the kids chased me all the way home. He said, I refused the next day to go to school without a coonskin cap. Well, it just shows how these trends started. The first trend among the baby boomers was hop-along Casti outfits. You know, the little thing, and I mean they sold millions of those things. And then it was coonskin caps, and then it was the hula hoop. And a couple of guys out in California found out they could make those for 59 cents and sell them for $2, and they were manufacturing over 20,000 a day. And then all of a sudden, just like with the thing with the coonskin cap with Davy Crockett, that started one December, and they were selling those things by the next December. These little T-shirts, Davy Crockett T-shirts that they'd been selling for $3, they were selling for 39 cents, and you couldn't give them away. Because, I mean, all of a sudden, we had made consumers out of those, and now Davy Crockett caps are okay, but now we're going to move to something else, and something else, and something else. And that's exactly the way our society has become. You know, things that are in today may not be in tomorrow. And so we really made consumers out of these kids. Now, and we have this mass of people coming onto the scene, these baby boomers. Nobody was ready for them. When they started hitting the schools, we weren't ready for them. We didn't figure that out the whole time they were in high school and things. When they started hitting the college campuses, I know when I came to OU, the campus was growing at the rate of 1,000 students a year. And I mean, there was phenomenal growth in the universities. But now there begins to be competition, tremendous competition. Always before, it was fine. I mean, when they were small because of this herd and many of them. But then when they started coming out in the job market, I mean, we weren't ready to absorb all these workers. And so they started going back to school and all this kind of stuff. And some of you can remember that. I mean, always before, we'd told them, you're special. If you want to major in underwater basket weaving or nearly anything you want to, see, there was a time in America, it didn't make any difference what you majored in college, you'd get out and get a job. But you know that's not true today. I mean, there are people with master's degrees and other things that cannot get a job. And so That's what started happening when they started graduating and getting out there. And we saw something else happening. You know, there was a time, I know when I was a kid, if you were, when you got to be 18 years of age, you left home. I mean, you went somewhere. You went in the service, you went somewhere, but you didn't stay with mom and dad. Do you know that today, 75% of the people in America that are between ages of 23 and 28 still live at home? I mean, there was a time in America, if you were 28 years of age and still living with mom and dad, you were mentally retarded. I mean, something was wrong with you. There's a lady who's written a book, and I'll give you later a bibliography, and it's called The Postponed Generation. And basically what she says in that book is people who are 28 years of age today have the maturity of an 18-year-old of 40 years ago. And that's exactly right. Now, I don't mean that they're not smarter. I don't mean that they don't have a lot of information. Thank you. The reason I sound hoarse is the doctor, I found out about a few months ago, I have a paralyzed vocal cord. They don't know what caused it. It just came upon me, so I sound hoarse most of the time, but thank you. So anyway, the postponed generations, people are postponing important decisions. They're postponing marriage. I mean, you'll talk to somebody, she's 35. She wants to get married someday, and she'd like to have a family. But it's amazing how they're postponing major decisions. You will see this. It will. Some of you older men, it absolutely amazes you. You look at them and you think of the we see it as immaturity. But let me tell you, there's some things that have happened to them, and we're going to talk a little bit more about them. Let's look at this. If you will, the baby boomers that I'm talking about, those that were born between 46 and 64, 79 million in our society, almost 32% of the U.S. population. Over 4 million babies were born each year during this time. They felt they were special. This was a great expectation generation. Incidentally, on the bibliography later, there's a book I'd highly recommend every one of you read called The Great Expectations. It's probably the best book that's ever been written to help you to understand this baby boom generation. Now, many of you, how many of you in here were born between 46 and 64? Okay? You will read that and probably understand yourself much better just as a result of having read that book. Great Expectations, and I'll point that out on a bibliography later and have all the information for you. Now, this was the first generation that did not have to be concerned about economic survival. Now, let me ask you, does this help you to understand our president? See, we're going to have it all. See, this is what we told the baby boomers. You're not going to have it as hard as we have. You're going to have it all because mom and dad have worked hard for you to have everything. And see, now we've got a baby boomer president. I mean, if you read about the baby boomers, all you have to do is look at the White House to see exactly why he acts like he does. I mean, we're going to have it all. You don't even have to work. We're going to have health care for everybody. See? And I mean, that's the baby boomer mentality. It's the idea of they had tremendous expectations. Now, most of you here, you'll say, well, I don't necessarily feel that way about some things. And because you're a Christian and because of the influence that there's been in your life, many of you, you don't necessarily feel like the baby boomers in some ways. But it will certainly help you to understand the people you're trying to work with.
The other factor in there, of course, is pregnancy. A lot of us grew up with.
That's right.
And
see, one of the things I didn't say about the seniors and about the builders, see, they were scared to death. My dad was, and people like that that remember the Depression. They grew up, they worked hard, they saved because they knew what it was like before. But see, when the baby boomers came along, we said, you're special. I mean, we gave them the best of everything. I mean, they had the best baby food, the best doctors, the best everything. And so then, when some of them hit the job market, I mean, all of a sudden, it was cruel because they weren't ready for that. We said, go ahead, honey. If you like art, just major in it. Now, let me tell you, you get a degree in that. Like some of these kids are going to school, they're going to major in communication. You know, that sounds good. Okay? 45% of them are going to take a below-level, college-level job if you major in that. See? And so it's no longer just go to college and get a degree. Because there are people that every year are getting degrees and cannot get jobs. And so there's something scary out there. And one of the things that you're going to find is some of those people, because they're having rude awakenings, you know, the world didn't is not facing them with open arms. And so a lot of those people are going to be very, very open to the gospel. Some of the ones that I think we flat will not be able to reach on the college campus until they hit the wall. But some of them will in years to come. Okay? College degrees and full-time work with women became common. Now, let me tell you, for the first time, see, one of the things a lot of people think when you think of the American, when you think of, you try to explain what the Bible says about marriage, I know they're thinking of the traditional marriage. Well, the old traditional marriage, as we knew it, as I knew it growing up, was not necessarily the biblical concept. Because the way many of us grew up, the dad was absent. I mean, he went out there, he worked. When he came home, he was emotionally divorced from the family. I know that was the way I grew up. Dad went out, he worked hard. When he got home, it was all over. Don't bother him. He sat down to eat. He didn't say thanks. He didn't do anything to the dishes. He didn't do anything to anybody. He went in and he read. Or he did something like that. So it's pretty divorced from the family. Some of you grew up in families like that. Now, but now we've got something, and we're going to talk about this later when we get to the baby busters. And now kids are growing up, and not only is dad no longer in the home, but mom's not in the home either. And we're seeing this on a college campus today, the effect that's had in kids today when they've grown up. Both mom and dad have worked full-time. They've had very little time for the kids. And I tell you, these kids are looking for relationships. And that's one thing about it. They want some meaningful relationships, which will be tremendous help, I think, as you try to disciple people. The baby boomers wanted a more comfortable life, and they've had it due to technology. You can flip over on the back, and then there's a baby buster. This sheet will just give you something of an overall picture of the different groups. Homogeneity is gone due to the influx of immigrants, the different philosophies, lifestyle. Now, the baby busters, this is interesting, earning their loyalty never ends. You know, as you're trying to disciple people, you want their loyalty. Let me tell you, with baby busters, you earn it again tomorrow. You earn it the next day. You earn it the next day. And see, that's hard where you want commitment. I tell you, on a college campus today, this is true of so many of the students. I can tell a group of students, 2 years from today, we're going to do this. And I can tell them tomorrow. Now, you know, 2 years from on a certain date, we're going to do this. 2 years from now, you can tell them every day for 2 years. And that afternoon, if a better option comes up, they'll take it. They're into options. You know, when they first started building cars in this company, you'd get a Model T. And then the day came when you could either get it black or blue. You had two options. I mean, if you didn't want a black one, you got a blue one. That's all there was. But look at the options today. And see, we're tremendously into options. And people are that way. That's why people out there, they're into options. You come along, you want to disciple this person. You want his loyalty. You'd like to have him lock, stock, and barrel so you can do something with him. Let me tell you, you're one option as far as he's concerned to start with. Isn't that right? So earning their loyalty never ends. The busters have, and this is a statement by George Barna, busters have not committed themselves to building character through achieving spiritual depth. They seem to lack the emotional stability and endurance to withstand the battle of wills and values. They do not have a culture. Now, these are the baby busters. These are the ones that were born since 1965. They do not have a culture. They do not have music. They do not have fashion. They have no heroes of their own. Now, it wasn't true of the busters. I mean, the baby boomers, they had heroes. You know, Hopalong Cassidy was their first one, and Davy Crockett, and all of these different ones. But this group doesn't. In fact, is through a survey, they took who is the greatest hero, The one that got the most votes only got 8%, and that was, you know who that was? That's President Reagan. And so this group is a conglomerate. They don't have their own music. They like some rock. They like some rap. They like, you know, this, that. And so it's a conglomeration. You'll see this in the clothing. I mean, a guy will, see, it amazes me to see a kid with Levi's and a white shirt and tie. I mean, you that are older, I just kind of shocks you. But, I mean, you'll see that. I mean, he'll go to a big dance or party or someplace you're supposed to dress up, and he'll wear Levi's and a white shirt and tie. I mean, to me, I mean, growing up, you know, we had a dress code, and it was different. But they'll mix and match. They do that with philosophies. There's no sense of ownership over their own lives. They feel like they're living in a world dominated by the boomers. They also have some resentment towards the older people because they feel like you messed it up. You came in, and now we have all these giant problems. We have this giant debt. You're going to die off and leave us to pay it off. And leisure is no longer a privilege, but it's a right. You know, used to, you work hard, and if you got through, then you could go play. Friend, there's a whole different mentality with this group. They're going to play if nothing else happens. See, leisure is very, very important to them. Okay, hand out the second handout, if you will. It's already out? Okay, characteristic of the baby busters. Let's look at this in a little more detail. Now, this is the busters. These are the ones that are born between 46 and 64, those 18 years. Then they were the entitled generation. I'm entitled to it. College is a right and not a privilege. You know, there was a time to go to college as a right. You know, you can go to the University of Oklahoma. You want to get a right started on the campus, you raise the tuition. I mean, students will get upset about that. Why? They think, well, listen, I was born in America. You owe me an education. Okay? Busters. Yeah. Okay, excuse me. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I did. That's the ones born since 65. This is a busters. Now, this is the college generation we're talking about now. They like to play. They like lots of toys and possessions. They want everything handed to them. They don't like the Mac jobs, that is, McDonald's or Mac whoever. You can pay them well, but there's no prestige in an hourly wage. They don't like that because there's no prestige. They don't want to climb the corporate ladder. They want to ride the elevator. I mean, these people come in from the job, one of the first things they want to know is, where's my office? Now, there's a mistake here. It says they want satisfaction, and that's without sacrifice, not with sacrifice. They want satisfaction without sacrifice. They are the now generation. Now, buy now, pay later. They want everything fast. They grew up that way. You know, everything is, even life problems in TV, they grew up watching it. That was their babysitter to a large degree. Everything happens in 30 minutes. I mean, even life problems can be solved in an hour or so. They lack options, not commitments. There are so many choices, so they postpone decisions. One of the things in working with them, commitments need to be stair-step. You may not be able to get his full commitment, but you can get him to commit to meet with you tomorrow afternoon and talk or something like that. But you may not. So you're going to have to take commitments in stair-steps. Short-term episodes. And sometimes a student, if you go ask him to be in Bible study and it's going to meet on Thursday night, well, he tends to think Thursday night the rest of my life or the Thursday night for the rest of the semester. Well, maybe they're having a basketball game one night and I want to go. So some of our discipleship stuff probably needs to be in shorter terms where we go and say, I'd like for you to be in this Bible study for 4 weeks. Now, if you miss one, you miss the fourth of it. We're going to meet every night on Tuesday night for the next 4 weeks. Then at the end of that 4 weeks, you can say, now we're going to start a second stage for the next 4 weeks or whatever, but kind of stair-step it because they're more likely to make short-term commitments than they are long-term. They like spontaneous events, not things that are well-planned. So they like to be spontaneous. Sometimes a big well-planned event, long-range, you know, they're very spontaneous. Hey, let's go do this. And so that's just the way they are. They're the disillusioned generation. They grew up, you know, facing the nukes, AIDS, homelessness. They've become apathetic, pacifist, ambivalent, unwilling to tackle problems they didn't cause. So they carry some resentment and anger towards your parents and towards your baby boomers. They're the postponed generation, dragging out adolescence and some of those things I've already mentioned to you. Now, notice they're kind of emotionally more like an 18-year-old, not mentally particularly. They're smart. They know a lot, but they're behind in some ways. They put off important decisions. They're the lonely generation. There's been high mobility. You know, it's interesting. Probably the baby boomers went to concerts and went to things in groups. They even listened to music alone. You'll see them with their earphones. You see them on campus walking across between classes, maybe have earphones on. So they're very lonely generation. They have very few role models. They couldn't agree on role models. Even Ronald Reagan only got 8%. They're slow to establish relationships. Now, when it comes to dating and things, they kind of give the come on signal and then stay away signal. They're very confused in a way. They want relationships, but they're very ill prepared to be able to build them because they didn't grow up having good relationships with mom and dad. Mom and dad were very busy, both of them working, didn't have much time for them. And so this group, more than probably any generation, long for relationships, but they don't know how to build them. And so that's one of the areas in which we can be a real help to them. They're the synergistic generation. They're totally comfortable with contradictions. Now, let me explain this to you. See, this will absolutely blow some of your minds. See, I always thought, and all of America believed, before somewhere this began to... Francis Schaeffer says this began to change probably about 1928 in America and along in there. But there was a time in America where if something was right, something else was wrong. See, like I grew up believing that if it's right to be faithful to your wife, then it's wrong to be unfaithful to her. In other words, morality is right and immorality is wrong. I mean, wrong. That's all there is to it. But to them, it kind of depends on the situation. And see, they will believe two absolutely contradictory things. Like, for example, we say, Jesus Christ is the only way. They'll say, that's, yeah. And then they'll say, Mohammed is the only way. I believe both of them. Now, wait a minute. One is exclusive. I mean, if you believe Jesus Christ is the only way, you cannot believe Mohammed is also the only way. Oh, well, yeah, you can. Now, see, to me... To us, that just blows our mind. We can't. But they live with contradiction. They say, well, yeah, Jesus is the only way for you. That's right for you, but Mohammed's the only way for this guy. See? You understand that? I don't understand it either, but I'm just telling you, that's where they are. See? And that's why it's hard sometimes for older guys. You know, I know that's one of the reasons I'm reading, trying to learn everything I can. I don't want to get left out because I've seen what happens when our culture and things bypass some people and we lose our effectiveness in ministry. Because these people will believe two things that are absolutely contradictory. And that's hard for us to understand. But they do. Yeah, it does. Okay. They have little need for consistency. See, consistency to us is a big deal, not to them. Their five main values are leisure, recreation, they love to have fun, and they work to live. Now, see, the baby busters, which is many of you raised your hand, see, your generation to a large degree, you guys, you live to work. I mean, they are the ones that started climbing the ladders, it produced the yippies, all these different groups and things, worked hard, moved up the corporate ladder, this type of thing. This group is, they've looked at that and they've seen enough of that. They don't want to live that way. So they work to live. That's why they will get out of college and get a job, and most of the our graduates that I've talked to the last 2 years, they don't plan to be at the same company 2 years from now. I mean, they're going to work somewhere, they get a little ahead, they may take off, they may take a trip, they may do whatever, but most of them have no sense. See, the other thing, they don't have a sense of loyalty. See, when I grew up, my dad was a Chevrolet man. I remember we could get at a family reunion. My uncle was a Ford man, and they'd sit there and argue about which one. My dad said, you still got that old clunky Ford? Now, my dad wouldn't drive a Ford for any reason because he's a Chevrolet man. He had a loyalty to Chevrolet. He'd never seen anybody in Chevrolet, but he had loyalty to them. These kids don't have a loyalty to anything. I mean, if a Honda's cheaper, stick it in your driveway. See, there's not a sense of loyalty. There's not a denominational loyalty most times. There's not a church loyalty. There's not a loyalty necessarily to anything. Okay?
Those people are working their way into corporate leadership too.
That's right. Now,
they carry that thought category.
And one of the things, men, this is not in the notes anywhere, but I'll tell you later on the bibliography, there's a book called 20-something. Any of you guys that are going to be working 20-year-olds, y'all read that book. Because basically what that book says is you're the ones going to have to change. It's not going to be them. Because they're not going to change. I mean, they're not. Because we're going to give it to them anyway. I mean, you don't have to work in America any longer to live. And so we're going to give it to them, health care, everything else, they're going to have it. And not only that, but as the population gets older, there's fewer and fewer workers. Because the baby bust is over. Now, the baby boomers, we had a lot during the baby boomers, we had a lot of babies. Now, we have less of that. There's going to be less workers. And as a result of it, you're going to have to compete for them. And the day will come, they say in America, as more and more people retire, there are going to be fewer workers. Businesses are going to have to compete for them. And he wants to get off at 3 o'clock on Friday and play golf. And if he's going to work for your company, he's going to do that. And you're going to put up with that. And see, basically it says that you better do some reading and just see what they're thinking, because there's going to have to be some change. Now see, we want them to shape up, have the old work ethic and everything like we did. But you might find that it's going to be a hard time selling that one. And I'm not saying that they won't change some, and I think they will. And we're going to talk later about what this means for ministry. Okay? They like leisure. Now, even they like work to be fun. And therefore, if you can do something, even at work, where it's a little bit of fun, I mean, they love fun. Now, their family, people value what they've missed, and they've missed good relationships at home. They long for stability. This is the first generation that are called the children of divorce. And one half of them, like you walk on the college campus today, one out of two students you'll see is from a broken home. Now, you take that other 50% that are not from broken homes and think in that home how much abuse there might have been, sexual, physical, emotional, and stuff like that. I'm telling you, the kids on the college campus today and the young people, it's amazing the tremendous problems among them. So they've missed family values. They long for stability. Marriage is primarily seen for companionship. And that is a high value for them. They say they want a good family. Well, now see, I think this opens tremendous doors for us in discipling those people. They want what you have. They don't know how to have it. They don't know how to build good relationships, but that's one of the things they want. They want a good family. They want freedom. They want experience. They want to feel God. See, in other words, they're not interested in some theology course. It's interesting. See, the generation today, what you have in abundance, you don't appreciate. I mean, how much do you sit around and think about the air you breathe? Because it's so abundant, you don't think that much about it. Well, see, years ago, I know when I was a college student, when I first heard about the navigators, if some navigator or somebody that knew something about follow-up and training was speaking 100 miles over here, I'd drive over there to hear him. Because I didn't know anything, and I knew I didn't know anything, and I wanted to learn. And boy, I was hungry for knowledge. And this group is not hungry for knowledge. They grew up during the knowledge explosion. You know, I was a note taker. I mean, I got reams of notes at home. I mean, every time I listen to anybody, I take notes. These group, most of them are not note takers. I mean, if they want information, they know how to go pull it up on a computer or something. See, they grew up in the knowledge explosion. So they're not near as hungry for knowledge as you were. So, like I was telling Bob, they had a NAV conference last fall in Oklahoma City. And I look around and the same kind of conference as some of the very people leading them here. I think, man, fantastic. And I mean, here it is in Oklahoma City. We probably had, what, 300 or 400? I don't know what we had, but and it's a good conference. But I thought, you know, it just amazes me that there wouldn't be more people that come. But you'll find that a lot of these people, they're not that hungry for knowledge. They're not going to jump on everything and take notes on it like you would, because they grew up with knowledge. Knowledge is not all that important to them 10 years ago. And I'm reading Jim Peterson's new book. Some of it's just come out recently, called A Lifestyle Discipleship. And he said, you know, I was raised around the NAVs in the early days when you go for the goers. You know, you pick the key ones and go with them. And he said, but when I went to Brazil and you work a year and a half to try to get this guy to accept the Lord, and he's got some problems, I'm not about to turn him off because he's not a key man. I mean, he's the only man I got. And so I'm going to work with him. It's kind of like, guys, when it comes to discipling, when I first came to University of Oklahoma, I could pick this one, and I can pick that one, and I can pick this one to work with him. But when my wife and I had a little boy, I mean, we had to work with him. See, when you have your own, you just work with them. I mean, they got problems, you still work with them. Now, I'm not saying that there can't be some selection and that Jesus was, but I'm also saying that I'm finding I don't have as good a selection as I once did. Because I'm just finding that we're finding more kids with deeper problems. I remember years ago I walked in the dorm witnessing one night and talked to this kid, and he claimed to be an atheist. I said, "You're a junior, aren't you?" And he said, "Yeah, how'd you know?" And I said, "Well, you have to be here at least 3 years before you're this messed up." Because I never bumped into a freshman that was an agnostic or atheist, but I'm telling you what, they're all over the campuses today that will claim to be agnostic or something. And why? I was in the dorm some time ago, and a fellow and I were sitting out in the lobby talking, and this kid walked in. I'd never seen him before in my life. And he stands there and he talks to this kid for a minute. Sitting over here visiting the boy, and then he walks on down the hall, and I said, "That boy, I bet you any amount of money, that kid's from a divorced home. I've never seen him. I've never talked with him. And it wasn't because of something I heard him say." But later, we're visiting down the hall, knock on his door. This kid comes to the door. I begin to talk with him. As I visit with him, I find out he's from a divorced home. I mean, the bitterness and the hurt. And I mean, there are kids out there that have been through an incredible amount of hurt. I mean, we're finding kids that on the college campus because of their home life and things that are really, really hurting. They're tired of talk. They want to see it live. They want to watch. They want to participate. Experience, I mentioned, they're short term. They're the visual generation. That's why, for example, I went up to Willow Creek. And I read John MacArthur's book on the shame, you know, of the gospel. But I noticed that some of the fastest growing church in America is Willow Creek. And that and Rick Warren's church out in California, both of them use some of the same principles. I was at Willow Creek not long ago on Saturday night, 5,000 people there. There'll be 5,000 the next morning at the early service, and there'll be 5,000 at the later service. And they only have 1,900 members. And one of the things they've done, they've used drama. Now, not to keep from presenting the gospel, but they use that to open people up. Like if he's going to preach on marriage, he'll have about a 6-minute drama. It's one of the sharpest things you've ever seen. So that old boy sitting out there feels like, boy, somebody knows where I am. And then when he gets up to open the word, these people are listening. Now see, these kids grew up. Like I used to see the time in which I could take a tape. I'd take Barn to Reproduce, pick up 5 guys, we'd go out in a tent, camp for the weekend, and man, that's all it took. I remember taking John Repass and some of these guys years ago, and we'd take Barn to Reproduce, some go out in a tent and listen to those tapes, and man, that was great. But these kids grew up with, you know, today tapes are not nearly as interesting to them. I mean, they're the visual generation. See, they grew up watching things, and so we're going to have to be sharper, I think, in our presentations as far as our bigger meetings and things like that. We focus so much on the cognitive. For them, it needs to be active. They need small groups. They need places to open up. And the baggage from their father or their parents will be carried over to their leaders. Discipline is therefore sometimes painful. Sometimes because of the way they felt towards their dad and the way some of the older people had hurt them, you're going to find sometimes that their attitude towards you is you're trying to help them. So don't be shocked. Just stick with them. They're worth it.
Maybe interrupt.
Yes.
In the context of that, you have another couple, for lack of a better term, and I'm tempted to say mature couple. You could almost do what we try to do with international students? Parenting and that sort of thing?
I don't know, but I just told someone today that I'm seeing to win some of the students on the campus is more like witnessing the internationals. You know, with the internationals, it's helping get to know them and helping them with driver's license or whatever, and it's slower. And I'm finding it to just go knock on a door, witness to a strange person. We rarely have a student like that except the Lord. It's usually, that's why we stress with our students, especially living on the floor, try to live in the dorm with them as much as possible, get them in Bible studies and things like that. Now, if there's a way to have older people relate to them, because they do have a respect, and we're going to see later, one of the ones they most respect are those from the builder generation, some of the older ones, you know, and the older baby boomers that they have some respect for. And so couples and people, if they can, and you can have them in your home and things like that, I think they would respond to that. So I don't know. We may see more of that.
While you were in California, did you knock on the
door,
college
life there? No, I didn't. I've not been out there and had the privilege of doing it. I've been to some retreats and things and talked to some students, but haven't been.
Late 50s, early 60s, but even then.
Yeah.
Everything that had ever worked here, SMU, North Texas, et cetera,
didn't work here.
Did not work in California.
And see, usually, man, one of the things...
30 years ago.
See, we think... Now, I put another book on this bibliography. One of the books, another book I'd highly suggest you read, called The Nine Nations of North America, in which this guy, secular writer, says we look at the United States as the United States. He said a United States is not one nation. It's really nine different countries. And he talks in there about the difference, how people, even in different sections of the country, react. Now see, we saw this, like, at one time, in Europe, all the theology came from Europe and it hit the East Coast. The liberal theology hit the East Coast and wiped out the seminaries there. I mean, I'm talking about liberalism years ago. And you wonder why that is. Well, one of the things, men, the seminaries in Europe are not controlled by the church. They're controlled by the university. It'd just be like at the University of Oklahoma if we had a theology department. They couldn't care less, the regents, what you teach in their theology, as long as you drew students. So there's no control over the seminaries in Europe. I mean, they're part of the state school system. And so the theology over there can be horrible, and it is. And that's why Europe's in the condition it's in. The people trained in the seminary were trained in a state university. Had no control. The church had no control over it. And then, of course, it hit the East Coast and wiped it out. And then eventually it trickles down into the South. See? And usually it comes from California and the East Coast and things like that. And then it hits in the area where we are. The reason we don't see this as much is because we're in the South. And because our parents had more of a work ethic in this type of thing. But see, that's exactly true. Some of the very things that worked here will not work in California. I mean, it's just like going to a different nation almost. There's an R here, and I forgot what it was, and that's why it's not on there. So don't worry about it. You got all you can handle anyway. Leading baby busters. Yeah, okay. 20-something workers. Let me tell you some turn-ons. Recognition, praise, time with you. And these are things that will turn them on. Learning how what they're doing right now is making them more marketable. Opportunities to learn new things, fun at work, structured play, practical, harmless jokes, small, unexpected rewards for jobs well done. Turn off, hearing a bun. You know, you used to walk 6 miles carrying your tube on the back, you know, and stuff like that. Another turn off is inflexibility about time, workaholism, being watched and scrutinized. Now, they like some feedback, but they want you to have some confidence in them. Being disrespected, feeling pressured to convert to traditionalist behavior, despairing comments about their generation's taste and lifestyles. Leadership they desire. The successful leader in the 21st century will be a coach, a mentor, a supporter, and a people person. Know them, coach them, value them, and involve them. Work environment desired. Active participation in decision making. They want to know clearly what is expected of them, and it's important to have fun. On the back, valued immediately for the skills they bring to the job. They desire consistent feedback. How am I doing? Flexible work schedules. The number one priority is not work, but outside interest and relationships. Give them trust and empowerment, guidance and parameters, then autonomy and independence to carry through with my responsibilities and make decisions. Value system, the most prevalent value system around the 20-somethings are the achiever, the involver, and the choice seeker. The achievers, and I'll not go through that. You can read that later, but this is from the book 20-something, and this is about in the workforce. That would be a good book if you have time to read it. Now look at the other one. The views depends on the angle. I think your next sheet. Boomers are not the only yardstick against which a generation can be measured. And of course, there's nothing to suggest that how many people view the busters is any more significant than how the busters view others. Consider this alternative angle on intergenerational views based on accumulated research. Here's how each of the last three generations would view its counterpart. Now the builders think of the boomers as disrespectful, overly blunt, greedy, possessing warped values, and leading unbalanced lives. And some of you, the older men, you knew that's exactly what you thought your kids were like and some of their friends. They envy their education, their mastery of technology, their drive for leadership. Now, the builders think of the busters as unusually immature. I think you can understand that. Immature, lacking a sense of ethics or morality, lazy, meddling, and emotionally unstable. Yet they're the hopeful that the busters will arrive at a thoughtful, alternative value system to that of the boomers. It's assured that they are off to a slow start, but they may turn out better for it. The boomers view the builders as rigid, inflexible. That's the way some of you viewed your parents, probably. Rigid, inflexible, old-fashioned, too cautious for their own good, predictable. generally out of touch with the real world. Concurrently, they respect their consistency, their pioneering spirit, and they're intrigued by their traditional ethics and morality. The boomers view the busters as selfish, impertinent, manipulative, aloof, passionless, and lacking in marketable skills and insights. Then again, they see a lot of themselves in this younger segment and hope to fine-tune some of their errant views they now possess. The busters perceive the builders to be unwilling to change, wise, anachronistic, more excited about history than the future, and boring to be around. Many busters also appreciate what the builders were able to do to overcome the barriers of their day. A few heroes of the busters tend to be the builder generation. Busters think of boomers as workaholics, too superficial, selfish, undimensional, impersonal, uncaring, and unrealistic. They acknowledge that the boomers had the guts to challenge the system, that they have made the world a more interesting, albeit confusing, place, and they share a similar passion for excellence, for quality leisure time, and for the chance to create rather than inherit a predetermined future. Now look at the insights for ministry sheet. Establish relationships, a key to winning their trust. They've experienced much rejection. I tell you what, when your dad walks out on you, when your child, I mean, you talk about rejection. And many of these kids have had deep, deep hurts. They've been let down by those they trusted the most. So spend time with them. Listen to them. Find out about their hurts, their hopes, and their fears. Establish a core. They want to be a part of the decision-making process. They want to know why and what's in it for me. And have fun with them. You know, the Bible does say a lot about heaven and reward and things like that. So it's okay to let them know. You know, we think, well, that sounds selfish. What's in it for me? But the Bible does say about some things about reward. And you can encourage them about, hey, if you'll persist, here's some of the things that you're going to... You can have a great marriage, but you're going to have to work at it. So you can, and let them know some of the rewards and some of the things that happen. Have fun with them. And see, guys, this is something that... I remember Merle Kimmerling telling me years ago, I was telling him about the Bible studies, and he said, yeah, but what are you doing to have fun with them? See, nothing builds morale like fun. And you can, and getting to know people, like for example, if you're out here playing volleyball and you don't have enough to play and a guy walks by and he's standing there watching, you say, hey, come over and play. And what's your name? Well, Fred. And old Fred makes a good spike and everybody goes over and slaps him on the back. Hi, Fred. I mean, all of a sudden, tremendous identity through fun. Do things with them. Have some fun with them. So that's one thing that they'll really appreciate. Keep messages short. They get bored easily. But challenge them. Keep things laid back but unpredictable. Now, when I say one of the things they want, they like it straight. We're not asking you to soften your message. I mean, tell them like it is straight. I was talking to BSU director out at Irvine, and he said he found this with the students out there. Man, they want you to tell it just exactly like it is. But it doesn't have to be in an hour message. Okay? Keep things laid back and unpredictable. They grew up on TV, MTV action, so don't give them dull church meetings. You know, they lack some action. Don't expect long-term commitments at first. They aren't volunteers. Remember, they're in a survival mode. Their focus is on themselves. Establish a relationship and let them know that you care about them. Be relevant. Be transparent. Be spontaneous. They don't like glib and pat answers. They like things that have some depth. Need to see how you use what you teach. In other words, man, let them see your life. Let them see how it works. They're best reached through friendship evangelism, not confrontational outreach. See, they resist authority. See, at one time, I, being an older fellow, knock on the door, they had respect for me because I was just older, if for no other reason. And so there are not many of these people probably going to be reached by more of a confrontational, sit down, I want to go through this track, as much as they are. And, of course, that's what you've found. That's what you know at work. It takes some time and sharing and witnessing to people. They can resist authority. Don't expect them to respond well to a ministry that's designed for boomers and builders. I had a friend who went to California and they helped start a new church to reach baby boomers. And they really reached baby boomers. And he said, we found out the baby busters don't like it. And so some of the things that maybe you like, they might not like as well. They need strong, nurturing leadership that clearly communicates goals and purpose. They need feedback and direction. Busters are motivated by encouragement, respect, recognition and praise. Boy, he memorized that verse, encouraging, praising. Now here again, I'm not asking us to pitch thing and make it unrealistic. We're just saying, here's where the person is. How can we help him to mature? Don't tell them what to do, show them. See yourself as a coach and a cheerleader. You know, I'm finding, guys, I'm just telling you what I'm finding, or what I'm finding. I'm having to cut our guys more slack than I used to. I'm talking about as far as our team meetings. There was a time that you know, if you're going to be on our team, you're going to come back a week before school starts. Now, most of them still do that, but we're having to cut some of them some slack. And sometimes they're going to miss a team meeting. And I don't like that as well. But I know, okay, I can be firm at this point and totally lose that kid. Or maybe I can encourage him and help him and be a little more lenient, realizing he doesn't come from see things exactly like I do at this time. Does that make any sense? See, I'm talking about, if I had 40 good men to choose from, I could be more selective. But sometimes I'm saying you take what God gives you. And I know this year when we started dividing up our teams and we had this girl, and I mean her life is a mess. She's hungry, she knows the Lord, but I mean she's just, her mom and dad are divorced, she's raised by her dad. Her dad abused her in a lot of ways, not sexually, but in some other ways. And so here's this girl. She wants to be on a team. She wants to be on this team. Some of her others are coming off the freshman ministry team on the discipleship team. Now some of them are coming off. And if we hold her back and we can try to make that other team to be on this team look real good for one more year, but it doesn't, and she knows it's rejection. So we pray about it. We talk about it. And my wife says, well, I think I can help her. So we bring her on. I mean, she is responding. She is doing great. But it's going to take some time. And I'm just saying, I'm finding that some of the people I'm having to try to disciple, it's taking longer, and we're not taking them as far as we once did. You know, I used to think, boy, when they get off this campus, I want them to be reproducers. And now I am desperately trying to help a lot of our graduates find some place when they graduate where you can go, where you can get further help. And I mean, you know, the NAVs and others have done that for a long time because we realize they're not finished products. They've got a great start. That's right. Yeah, right. That's right. That's right.
That's
right.
It's a, work or beginning work job.
Yeah. And so you'll see it. I mean, things that you wouldn't miss work for at all, but it's a good excuse for him. Now, he may be on a golf course, but he's too sick to work. Okay, Bruce? That's right. See, men, at one time, like when I started to school, what you learned basic school in a church and home wasn't all that different. Now, they didn't tell you a whole lot about Jesus at the church. But boy, I mean, if you lied or anything like that, it was... And my dad even said, you know, you get a spanking at school, you get nothing, you get home. Because the school and the home were pretty much allies. And now, due to separation of church and state, which is never the way it was intended, we've tried to take all values out. And now there are even some courses like at Harvard, they're wanting to offer a course in values. But see, we know that unless there's a higher ethic, unless we're created beings, there's no way to have values. You can't teach values unless you've got a base. And so they don't know how to teach them. Yeah. Right. Yeah, they've got some hard lessons to learn. And see, that's why we won't bend everything. But there are ways in which we can help soften that if we can and help them to get on the right road. I know our time is gone. You can read the rest of these. I believe our time's gone, isn't it? It's already gone? 10 more minutes. Oh, great. Okay.
May make it.
Don't tell them what to do. Show them. See yourself as a coach and a cheerleader. Give them activities so they can have fun. Many managers say this is their top priority. They want personal satisfaction out of everything they do. So, busters are very cause-oriented. Give them something to believe in and what to be a part of, and they will do anything for you. Now, see, I think there's tremendous hope for this generation because a lot of the things they most long for, now they don't know that it's in the Lord is where the answer is. But you know that. So let's make some of the adjustments to try to get through to them where we can get close enough to them to share with them. Now, take your bibliography and let me just mention a few books and things here. The Frog in the Kettle is something that would be real interesting for you to read. This is just about church. I'll just tell you about some of this. The Invisible Generation, the Baby Busters. George Barna probably done more than any man in America just as far as all kinds of surveys and everything about our culture. It'd be an interesting book. This, about the fifth one down, Joel Garreau, The Nine Nations of North America. Excellent on understanding different people in different sections of the U.S. You know, some of you have been in California know that Northern California is very different from Southern California. And basically what he does, he redraws a map. This guy was a newspaper man and worked in Chicago or someplace, and on weekends they're going out to do news stories. And so they begin to talk around the offices, all people saying, well, I'm going down to Tex-Mex this weekend. And they began to give different names, and as they found out that they're running into different attitudes. Like, for example, they redrew the map, and Los Angeles, the map comes all the way around and goes down to Houston. Houston is far more like Los Angeles than San Francisco is in a lot of ways. And so it's interesting about, like, for example, you remember a number of years ago when they had the plants up in New York, and how the people rebelled and all the things. Well, you know why? Because half the people up there got their doctor's degree. They like to sit around their pipe and burn wood-burning stuff in their stove. I mean, if they had even thought at all, they'd know you could not build a new, a hydroelectric plant or an atomic plant in New York. I mean, they were going to run into giant problems with that because these people are so concerned about the ecology. See, you could have done it in New Mexico, but you can't do it up there. And so you see things happening in our culture that people just don't understand where they live. I think that will help you. This book by Gibbs on 20-something, Floundering and Off the Yuppie Track, that's good. That's from the workplace, if you want to understand the 20s in the workplace. This Great Expectation, Landon Jones, American, the Baby Boom Generation, that's probably the best book that's been written on just understanding the baby boomers. This Postponed Generation, Susan Litwin, this is not a Christian book, but Why American Youth Are Growing Up Later. The Postponed Generation, she's the one that said they're 10 years behind, they're postponing major decisions. Used to, when a kid got out of high school, he basically got married or, went on to college or something, but now they're postponing these major decisions. Let's see if there's anything on the back. Articles. Here's some periodicals that you could go to a library and get that you might want to read. There's things that I've picked up different places, articles and things that maybe relate. See, I hope, if nothing else, this seminar might kind of help you to be a little bit more in tune with what's going on with these different groups. How do you go about discipling them? And so you begin to think, well, what's wrong? It's like I see our campus changing. We're spending more time. I think we have to work harder every year just to get what we got the year before. And I'm seeing students. It's just taking longer to get them. Because used to, if a kid came with a good, solid background, you gave him some basics, gave him some vision, and I mean, he's off and running. But now there's a lot of garbage that you've got to deal with, because he's from a divorced home, because his dad's an alcoholic, or all of this kind of stuff. There's such deep problems that sometimes it's taking longer. You can't just run at him sometime and say, have a quiet time. I mean, we had a girl one day, and we were going through a little discipleship thing, and one of the fellows, or the girl that was leading this, and you could not slow it down, slow enough for her to keep up. And so then one day I was talking to her. I said, tell me about your background. Tell me about your dad. She just broke down and started crying. Her dad's been sleeping with her since she's 9 years old. And I mean, when you talk about discipline, absolutely discipline is totally foreign to her. She basically is pretty well in her mental frame incapable of discipline right at this point. So we have to go out. We keep a fellow on our staff now. We have the last several years, a biblical counselor, just trying to help some kids through some deep stuff. And what I'm finding, men, we've got to be better prepared in the future to disciple men than we were in the past. I mean, used to is just basically learning the basics, learning the verses, learning some stuff. But I'm finding now I got to know, why won't this kid have a quiet time? I mean, what's eating him? I mean, why can't I get him to do this? See? And so I'm just saying that I'm finding for me, and I think it's true of all of us, we're going to have to be better prepared to help the kids in our day. Okay, questions or comments? Yes. Yeah, it is.
Like a creative farmer to me.
But when you, after you do that, sit down and talk about what this means to him. See, you've learned to pursue, and some things in life are hard. You know, one of the things you'll find as you read the, you know, people predicting the future, like, you know what the biggest problem was supposed to be in America in 1995? What to do with leisure time. The predictions were, and if you read, I believe it was 95 or maybe by the year 2000, years ago in Newsweek or one of the big magazines, they said the biggest problem in America was going to be what to do with leisure time, because we were going to be working, they thought, a 25-hour work week, and what do you do with all this leisure? Well, you know, the average person now in America works 45 hours a week. That is not the problem. So in studying and reading, and especially what the predictions are in the future, you have to weigh those. Now, there may be some things here that you might find, now, I don't think this guy's exactly this way. These are general things, but I do think they give us some insight into the people we're trying to work with. Okay?
Not tied to students necessarily, but tied to your leisure. I was floored
paper in the Philippines, and they would not permit work-saving devices to be introduced because it would put people out of work.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, saw the same thing in China.
Yeah.
And it's like they've got people sleeping in the street with a broom and a...
Right. I saw this in Nigeria, people getting out and cutting the grass along the highway with a machete.
I don't, you know, that is so far and I had trouble grasping it, but is that a possibility? I don't know.
Well, man, I just think we're seeing change so fast, and with what's happening as far as our government and the way it's going and abortion and all this, we're going to live with some real change. And it's going to get tough. It is getting tough in some ways, and I think it'll get tougher. And these people are going to need some help because they're gonna run into some hard things out there. And I think those of you, you've got stability, you've got some things figured out in life. Man, I hope this doesn't discourage you. The last thing I'd want to do is come in and discourage you from going about the things that you've learned. But I'm just saying, let's try to be in tune. Let's fine-tune it. We still want people to memorize verses, but I may have to cut him a little more slack in some ways to ever get him to do that and get him to see. I may have to talk with him a little bit more how it's going to benefit him than he used to just because of respect. I could tell a guy to do it and he'd do it.
They have to let him memorize out of the message.
Right.
You're talking about the change and what people are expecting. You've got to remember, historically, every time you roll a century, you have incredible change. You look at the last century going from 1890 to 1930, 25, airplanes, cars, telephones. Society in itself made a tremendous role. Well, we're going to have that this time, but we roll a millennium. Who knows what God has in store for this generation? Will definitely see things that have never been seen before. Not even fallen.
Well, guys, I'm 57, and I know for me personally, I'm working as hard as I've ever worked in my life at trying to read, trying to learn, trying to understand, because. And see, like my wife, her parents were just there. Her dad's 80. And I think that he's come all the way from early cars and horse and buggy, knowing about that all the way to jet airplanes and things. You talk about phenomenal change in his lifetime. And see, a lot of times, I mean, it's easy even for us when we feel like we have the answers to think, man, I got the answer. Shape up. Here it is. Bible study, 7 o'clock. If you want, you come get it because that's when I'm going to offer it. And see, I'm finding, it's different. It's just different. Is there a way you can cut this tape off for a second or whatever going on? That doesn't need to be shared, but you guys can pray also if you think of Barry and some others. And see, men, I know when Jim White, the phenomenal ministry he has in Norman with internationals, one of the things we found through the years, we tried to find people to work with internationals. A lot of very stable families and things, they said, well, you know, if I had them in my home, I don't know how to act. I mean, I don't know what to do. And you'll find that a lot of people, see, don't be afraid of these kids. They're a bunch of confused, frightened kids in a lot of ways. And I mean, they're running scared, like on a campus nowadays. They are studying. And they know that you don't automatically just get a degree and get out and get a good job. They know that. They've seen too much. I mean, a lot of them are seeing their dads lose jobs and things like that. And so don't be afraid of them at all. And see, that's what some people are afraid of internationals. They say, well, they're so smart and I'm not. See, and I think that's one of the things God may be doing to help bring the body of Christ together. You know, maybe you have a lot of expertise in the area of discipling, but if you can find somebody else that can just bring them over to your house for lunch and love them, you know, they do have a respect for some older people. Now, they don't always respect authority, but they respect what they see in your life. They want a solid family and that type of thing. Some of the very things that you have as a result of the Lord.
Hey, bro.
No, he doesn't mean disrespect.
But I finally gave up. I wouldn't call the DC or Delta Airlines and say, hey, Bob, what's going on?
But see, to him, that may be a kind of a... I wouldn't... It probably is. It may be for him a sense of endearment. I mean, you're just one of my buddies.
Right.
See, and if you don't understand that, you think, this disrespectful kid, and maybe he doesn't mean it that way at all. Oh, it is.
Matt, could you comment on the education system? You made a comment to this girl here about the first one, kind of about the attempt to assess the education system, what's being taught, making out the world out
there. Yeah, you know, if I had it to do over, because, what greatly influences a child sometimes is not so much maybe the teachers, it is his peers. They're tremendously influenced by peers. But also by what's being done and not being done in some of the schools. I think especially for the younger child, I would take a serious look at homeschooling in some situations. Sometimes maybe a Christian school, but now sometimes even in a Christian school, you still have the peer problems. Now, once a child gets older, he gets in high school or gets on up there, at least at the point where he's old enough. Maybe he's a junior or senior or somewhere. When he gets to college, I'm very much for... I know Dobson, I've seen some of the things he said. He really wants to see him in a Christian school. I think if a kid's on a state university campus but can be tied in with the Navigators or Baptist Student Union or what, you know, some group, crusade, where he's... Because he's going to be hearing stuff in school that he doesn't agree with, but if he has a support system, I think that's a tremendous time for him to transition. But I don't think you send a six-year-old out usually as a missionary. I mean, some of them do witness and things like that, but remember, God gave you those children. You're responsible for them. You don't... Basically, the educational system, you delegate to them. And therefore, I think we can have some say over what goes on and what doesn't. And but anyway, don't lose your children. I mean, that's the most precious thing God gave you. And I think the thing, it may be, and I'm just saying, like I had a doctor friend, when his son was in the fifth grade, his daughter was in the seventh grade, he said, I was realizing I was losing. And he said, we jerked him out of school so fast, homeschool for a while, and he's got his kids back. And so it may be that you need to do that for a year or so, or for a period of time.